friends. I'm Val.
I'm Courtney.
And I'm Lisa.
And this is My Perfect Romance.
Bow, chicka, bow, bow.
What about all of you?
Or how about my sweet love?
I think we all have a different idea about what romance is.
Well, what is the perfect romance?
Gosh, I don't know, but let's find out.
All right. Good morning.
Hi.
Morning.
Hey, it's morning. Lisa.
Val.
Courtney.
And we have Debbie Show with us today. Debbie Show is the author of Paper Roses. This book is, I thought it was amazing.
Oh, it's based very much on liked it.
Yes. True events. And so if you, and Debbie herself has been writing her whole life. And she is also a licensed marriage and family counselor. So she's got a lot of good background information. And as you read the book, you'll understand a little bit more about, you know, that in there. So I just wanted to, yeah, hit it off by saying, you know, you've got, your book's gotten some really good reviews. I really wanted to share this review by Midwest Book Review. They say about your book, it's original, exceptional, engaging, deftly crafted, and a haunting story of loyalty, silence, and the cults of breaking free that is based upon a true story and real life experience. Paper Roses showcases author Debbie Show's consummate skills as a narrative-driven storyteller, raise her novel to an impressive level of literary excellence.
Thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for reaching out, sharing your book. I thought it was incredibly well written.
Oh my gosh.
It was super well written. We all really enjoyed it.
You know, I loved how you captured the time eras. For me, the 70s when you're talking about Abby when she was young.
Yeah.
Just, oh my gosh. I'm like, it took me right back.
Well, and I loved the detail of how you brought your characters to life, like when the mom had the tag still hidden underneath. And I remember doing that in junior high.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
For the clothing so she could return it. So it was very well written. We loved your book.
Great details. And it was very immersive. Like I could visualize very well what
was
going on.
Oh, yeah. I love that too.
So thank you. And yeah, thank you for writing your whole life because you've produced a wonderful work of art.
I appreciate it. I really do. I worked very hard on that book. And I'm a pretty picky reader myself.
Mm-hmm.
I love to read and I love most writers. I'm a fan of most writers, but sometimes the saggy middle drives me crazy. So I tried really hard not to have like a saggy middle, you know, to have it like be engaging all the way through.
Yeah. I thought I loved, there was a sense of, always, as I was reading it, always wanting to keep reading because I wanted to know what was going on with each individual character.
What's going to happen?
Yeah.
And how you switch characters, it kind of keeps you on the edge of, well, what happened to the last character as you're reading? And then you're getting engrossed into the new character before you kind of go back to revisit the last one. It's so fun.
The thing I also, on top of that, I mean, you switch between three different narratives, but I think it was Elizabeth Gilbert who wrote Eat, Pray, Love. I can't remember the title of her other book that I read, or maybe it was a TED Talk. I don't know. It all kind of jumbles up inside here. But she said that to truly understand a person, you have to go back three generations because that's going to show you how they became who they are and just their upbringing. And I think you really did an excellent job. You know, between from grandmother to daughter to granddaughter. Because I feel like Abby was a primary protagonist and you got to really see where she came from.
Yes, mm-hmm. I love that.
And so that helped kind of really build her as a character. So kudos to you for writing.
And I feel like I felt very emotionally connected to all of the characters.
Absolutely.
You did such a good job of, I really was emotionally invested in each of them. And I think you really did a good job of helping, you know, a reader feel that way.
Right.
And I liked how you defined family by who actually was kind of showing up for you as much as by genetics too, because I really think that, get into more questions about the book and stuff and let you have an opportunity to answer all of our questions. But we just really enjoyed your writing.
Yes, we
did. And in case any of our listeners haven't read your book yet, I do want to, before we get into the questions, I kind of wanted to go over the quick, you know, a brief summary so they have some context for the questions, I guess.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to read like what the back cover says, because I thought it really encapsulated it well. Abby's life is thrown into chaos when her sister is arrested for the third time, this time for stealing over $1 million from the ex-wife of an NFL star. Searching for answers, Abby unearths long-buried family secrets reaching back to the 1940s Morocco. Along the way, she's forced to confront the echoes of trauma that shaped her, including a heartbreaking romance with Sai, a man whose warmth, honesty, and emotional depth masked the instability and lack of emotional regulation that haunted her mother. She married her unfinished business. In the end, Abby says goodbye to love and focuses on the family she created and the next generation. She has broken the curse. So I love that. It's kind of what encapsulates it really well. So to kick it off, I always like to know about a writer's writing process. Do you have any rituals? How do you carve out the time in your busy day? What does that look like for you?
Definitely, I was driven to write this book. And so what I would do is I would work in the workday because I had to keep it completely separate because I was not being paid to write this book. I was being paid to work. So I would get off of work about 5 o'clock and I would stop at Panera. I was going to call this book Panera because they have free Wi-Fi and I would sit there with a bunch of other writers. I kind of knew who the other writers were. We knew who we were. We'd kind of like, there was this other guy, probably about 5 days a week. I would sit there until they closed down, honestly.
Oh, wow.
Or if I didn't do that, I'd do it on the weekends. At first, I started on the weekends and I thought, oh, I need my weekends. So I would just do that. Like I said, I was going to call the book Panera. They all knew who I was. It was not good for my health. But I joined the little club where you get all the drinks for free for like a year. Yeah. Right. And it actually took me a year to write the first draft. And then I had to go back and do 9 more drafts to get it right. Oh. And I had a developmental editor that kept me on track. So I met with her either once or twice a month. She was more like a writing coach. She was a published author. Yeah. So she helped me a lot with, I was really good at writing the characters, but getting the story to where there were like a lot of, where people wanted to read it and a lot of cliffhangers. She helped me with that. And then making the characters relatable and likable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What you
did.
Yeah. As I said, I feel like you did. You succeeded in that.
But she helped me with that because sometimes it's really weird. I think most fiction is autobiographical anyway, but when you're writing about yourself directly, sometimes all your trauma and anger comes out on the page. You're like,
yeah, simmer that down a little bit.
But you also do a good job.
Yeah, no, that, it's like, excuse me. It's like Abby was living in a world of Karens. Everybody, everywhere she went, there's like that snarky humor.
Yeah.
And so it's like I had to like edit a lot of that out.
Yeah.
Was it kind of therapeutic for you though, going through the process of actually like focusing in on it?
Yeah, very much so. And the thing I like about fiction is you do have these aha moments even as you're writing it. It's like, oh my gosh, like I had no idea that was going to come out. And I think some of that is the ADHD. Like you get into that zone of creativity and then, wow, I wrote that. That's crazy. So it was very healing going back the generations and figuring out like why people became who they were. I wish I could go back further, but I don't know anything. I couldn't go back further because I don't know anything, but I went as far back as I knew.
Yeah.
Well, you were very generous to people too. So, you know, you really, one thing that I loved about the way you wrote your characters is, you know, even when they were making really bad decisions and you understood them as people, like you were like, okay, yeah, you still cared for them even when they were making decisions that you really wish they weren't going to do. You know, it's like,
you knew they were going to do it because you knew who they were.
Exactly. It was it was so well written that it never shocked you, but it still like really bothered you because you wanted to believe that they could do more and be better than they were. But on the same note, then you can just understand the whole need to also protect yourself from them. And so, just beautifully, you did such a good job.
Well, and on that note, I just want to ask, so having written this book, and it was based on a lot of, you know, family, has it been well received by your family? Has it created any waves or how's that been? Because
it's interesting. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think the sister character doesn't like it, but, you know, and I think it's been, I have a couple of family members that really liked it. A couple of people mm-hmm. don't know anything about Morocco because our family left Morocco in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, oh, wow, did that really, was it really that way? And did that really happen?
Yeah.
Because I have some cousins that are like 20 or 30 years younger than I am. So I got some of that. I haven't, you know, I got to ask my, I only have a couple relatives still alive, honestly, that,
yeah.
because my mom's gone. That was true in the story.
Yeah.
My dad's gone. There aren't many people. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's not easy to do, to get that information and research that. Did you actually get to go to Morocco and experience that? Because that was part of the book, too.
You had such amazing flavor for there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did go back. I went when I was a kid because I was not born there, but my mom was pregnant when she came over to the U.S. So I went, and then I went when I was a kid. So I have a lot of memories of Morocco, but I thought, oh, I better go back, you mm-hmm. know. So once I was done writing like the third draft, I'm like, if I don't get back, if I get any details wrong, oh my God. So I went back. Yeah, I went back. And you know, when I went back is when I went back October 7th. Believe it or not, I was in Morocco on October 7th. When,
like, we're talking 5 months ago, October 7th?
No, 3 years ago when they had the, Israel, when they took the hostages and all that. So it was, they had like a lot of people trying to leave the country. So yeah, I went back 3 years ago. I've been writing this book for a long time.
Yeah.
So
Oh, wow. Yeah. That would have been stressful.
Yeah.
Well, was Morocco, how do you feel about it now? Or did your memories of it hold up? Or
no, it was very different. Because when I went, when I was a kid, there was a lot of unrest there. And, you know, it was a lot of danger. Of course, I was being told, oh, very dangerous, very dangerous. And then when I went back, it's very touristy. It's kind of, in a lot of ways, very European because it's really close to Spain. So it's not dangerous at all. They want your tourist money. And they're very friendly people. I would recommend going because of, like, Casablanca is very cosmopolitan. And so I thought they were great. I love Morocco. Well,
this Morocco's the northwest corner of Africa, right? It's kind of the inlet to the Mediterranean.
Yeah, so you just go from,
you know, Spain
right down into the Mediterranean.
You can take a ferry.
Yeah. I was planning a trip to do that.
Great.
I had a trip planned to go do that, but then things
changed
in my life.
It's nice.
You kind of make me want to go
too.
As an ADHDer, I have dabbled in writing a little bit, but what got me into it was kind of for therapeutic purposes, to kind of sort through some things that I was going through in my life, and kind of make sense of who I am. No, was there a piece of writing this that felt therapeutic to you?
Yes, extremely so. Because let me get a drink first. More than therapy in a way, because you get to some emotional truths, you know, and you can't candy coat it. Cause like a lot of times when you're in therapy, you're being validated. They validate you. But in writing, it's like you're kind of being forced to face like the truth of who you are, of who other people are. And my developmental editor was hard on me.
That's a good editor.
That's a really good editor.
I wasn't like a therapist. It was like, hello.
She was like, you know, your point of view isn't the only one.
It was like tough love in a way.
Mm-hmm. So what, for timing reasons, what finally said, now is the time that I want to write about this? What was there a moment in you that you just said, okay, it's time now?
Yeah. So I always wanted to write it because everybody thinks their story is unique. I thought my story was unique. But when Tracy got arrested, when my sister got arrested the third time, I started thinking, oh my gosh, you know, this is our family. My sister I hate to diagnose, okay, but my sister has she's a psychopath. She has some real problems. And how did that happen? You think about people that write books about their siblings, and it's usually about the siblings. It's always like the bomber, his brother wrote a book, and then led to the BTK daughter wrote a book. It's kind of like, it just shakes you to the core. You're like, who is my family? Right. Who are these people?
Well, and then how did I end up okay when they didn't?
Yes.
Right.
Because you were both like in such a similar situation. And then you're just like, why, how did I get through that when they didn't? So.
And yeah, I have to say, you did such a fair, I thought you did a fair job. Like,
yeah,
I understood why, absolutely, you know, Nikki did the things that she did.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of empathy towards her. And me too. Like, I don't know that it could have panned out any differently.
Yeah.
Because if you had brought her up at any other time in her life without knowing, mm-hmm, yes, exactly what her childhood was like, even what her parents' childhood was like, you wouldn't understand.
Yeah. And it's like, and you can't like, and then you understand even where her mom came from. And so then you're like, oh, I can understand why she would have done these things. Oh, and you really did a very fair job. And I think your expertise in, you know, just in family counseling and psychology, mm-hmm, really, like, I'm so impressed.
Yeah.
With how genuine you approached all of that.
Because I like Nikki. At the end of everything, I still I like her.
Yes.
You know, and I sympathize with her. And
you can understand her. You get why she was who she was.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you said that because I really do understand why she is who she is. She actually hates me. She wrote in her prison blog, she thinks I'm the devil.
Well of course. She's going to have to. Yeah. Because that's how she knows how to justify it.
Excuse me, my throat. It's pretty early in the morning.
Yeah, I think it's sexy.
Yeah, it sounds like, hey.
Yeah, so, oh, thank you. No, the thing is I've heard that. I've heard that people can empathize. And I empathize for the child. I really do.
Yes.
Because I'm probably the only one alive, honestly, who could write about it, you know, that really knew what happened. And that's another motivator for writing the book.
Mm.
And she wasn't a she-devil as a kid. You know, she wasn't this crazy monster. And I do think, you know, I'm talking about the real story. I do think that what happened in Japan really shaped her.
Oh, gosh. Absolutely. That was so sad.
Yeah, problems before that. And the thing about empathy is that you can empathize, but then you got to stay far away, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just because you understand, I have a family that has a lot of colorful characters in it, mm-hmm, too. So it's hard to describe to family members, other people who don't understand how you can love someone, but you have to have boundaries
right
with them because they're genuinely not safe people. It's interesting. So I think you did such a beautiful job with that. And sometimes people can think, oh my gosh, you were so harsh at this part in your life because why didn't you just bend over backwards for me? You're like, because they would have drained me completely and taken me down with them in an unhealthy way. And so I think you did such a beautiful job of showing how you have to survive in those situations and how you can still have love even if you have boundaries. And sometimes people who aren't in those situations don't understand how important it is that you need to adhere to your boundaries. You can't save everyone on the ship.
No.
And it's hard.
And a choice to grab that life rope.
And it is hard. And it makes you wonder, I don't know for you, but in this, I really loved how you showed it because I could see how, you know, Alba was like, really like, you do have some survivor's guilt almost in some senses, like you almost feel. So that's why it's sometimes you break your own boundaries because you're like, well, why was I able to make it? And they didn't.
Yeah.
And I just think you approached all of those things so beautifully, genuine. It was nice to read that having had to make similar decisions. So it was, I just want to thank you for that.
Yeah, I'm hoping that I can help some people too, you know, that maybe they're not in the exact situation. But the one thing I want to say is people have asked me, like, if she came back in your life, if she begged for forgiveness or if she wanted a relationship, would you have one? And I have another sister who's not in the book because she needs to be. You know, she's in the middle of us. And the thing is, if you let my sister back or characters like my sister, like Nikki back, you'll get drawn back in because She's so good. Her mask is so great. You just want to believe as a sister, or I think just as a human being, most people want to believe other people, that I would get drawn back in and I'd be like, yes, you know, I'm on team Nikki. Yep. I believe you've recovered and you're not going to do it again. And these people have a way of getting people to return to the same poison trough, like again and again and again. And people don't understand like that.
Football. Yeah. Yeah. That's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can forgive them, but don't forget. I know I've that saying, forgive and forget.
But the, also, I think there also needs to be a third part to that is you also need to forgive yourself for any. It's the forgiving and forgetting that, you know, the forgiving, not forgetting with them is easy. I think the hardest part is always giving yourself permission to not hate yourself for needing to take care of yourself and not like you want to be someone who's always going to believe in a sibling. You don't want to be that person who has to set a very strong boundary with someone who totally steamroll you. You know, you don't want to have to be that person. And you're like, I'm a loving person. I'm a kind person. A loving, kind person would keep, you know, giving this person chances. And it's not mean to not keep giving chances. You can still love them without having to give them chances to steamroll your life. And I think that was just, for me, I really appreciate that you did that.
Thank you. Because I did get to know a couple of my sister's victims, talking about my sister, but just my sister is kind of like Nikki. They contacted me and they are the most loving. My sister attracts the most loving people.
Yeah, that's kind of how it works.
Yeah.
Maybe that's maybe a good thing that is coming from this, right? That you have met some amazing people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, completely. Like Jemana Kid is like Snow White. Like you could see birds coming in. Like Jemana Kid is like Snow White. Like you could see birds coming and landing on her animals. I mean, she really is. And so is Lori Ann Hart. Lori Ann Hart narrated the book for me because she's an actress. And I never would have been able to like afford anybody like get anybody as good to narrate. And she has all the emotion. She's one of those people that feels so deeply. She's like she's like a complete empath. And Lori Ann still, if you talk to her, she's still like, I believe in second chances. I believe in the good of everyone. I believe that your sister really, really did love me, you know? And so these are the kind of people, oh my God, my heart, these people are great. And I just had somebody contact me about a week ago after all these years. And she just, I think she wants to be like that. I think my sister wants to be like that. And she attracts these wonderful people. It's like, who are these people?
There's a lot of good people out there.
There's so many
people. There really are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to talk a little bit more about like the love aspect of the book a little bit. Because you know we're really into that romance and love.
Oh, yes.
And I love that this was three love stories kind of all rolled up into one. You've got, and I might mispronounce the names.
Oh, Yasmina? Yeah, me
too. Yeah. Yasmina?
So Yasmina. Yeah. Did I say it right?
You said it right.
Okay. Yeah. So Yasmina, who, like, my heart broke for her, like, back in, she's in Morocco, and she's basically sold off to a family very young to be married. And then they discarded her because she couldn't have children and then sent off to be a servant, which is how she first met Nanette.
Yes.
Yeah. So here is Yasmina, a very humble, kind, always selfless, looking out for Nanette. And did I say Nanette right? So, yeah. So you've got her. And Nanette, she was one of eight children, right?
So the boy. Yes.
That was my mom. She had nothing but brothers. Yeah.
Nothing. Yes. That's so what I thought.
Easy.
Which, and I had a really good friend like that growing up. And I always joke, like, she was so, like, I don't want to say spoiled, but a little bit. Because, like, the mom was just so happy to have a girl.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if maybe that was the same thing for Nanette, like, being one of eight and the only daughter. But
I was,
you know, she really, like, in a way, even though Yasmina was so kind to her, I felt like Nanette was a little bit short with her, a little bit condescending towards her at times, and but loved her at the same time. Like, there was a weird kind of dynamic in that relationship. And then you had Nanette that I thought was a little bit privileged, and maybe a little bit self-centered. But I can imagine being raised that, you know, it's like the only daughter. And also having to look out for yourself because she was
be so strong. That school was terrible.
Well, and kind of having to survive in a family of
boys
is you've got to really put yourself out there.
And at a school where people hated you.
And you had no protection.
Yeah. So she had to get a pretty tough, thick skin, self-preservation wise. And so I think it was interesting the way that like Yasmina, later on when she moves to America with with Nanette's aid, but sort of misled by Nanette, like, you know, she was still so kind and selfless, but Nanette felt like she was somebody who held on to her tough exterior and kind of really always looked out for herself and herself only. So I thought that was really interesting. And the way that played out. And my question around that, like, so you've got these two characters and they meet and fall in love. Nanette meets Hugh in Morocco. Yeah. And it's like love at first sight. They're at that party and you can tell Hugh. It's told from Hugh's perspective.
Yeah.
You know, you can tell that he's like really thinking like, oh, she's too good for me. And I want that.
He's like, nailed it.
It takes him on like almost all night to ask her to dance.
Uh-huh. Yes. And then you've got Nanette who she, after she moves to America, she's learning to speak English. Like you could see the sparks flying that first night. Yes. And you knew right away. But then the story cuts. I'm like, ooh, what's going to happen? Are they going to work out or are they not? And then it skips forward several decades and you know, oh, it did work out. So as a writer, like a lot of times when you're doing that whole fall in love, you watch the characters like kind of pull away from each other and question, is this going to work? And then they like overcome these big barriers. But we didn't see that part. They kind of remained steadfast in who they were. So was that part of the writing? What's the word? Method
in order to keep more focus on the relationships and the family generation, the female sides of what was happening.
Yeah.
It was my daughter-in-law is a reader and she read one of the drafts and she's like, how do I know they even got married? I'm like, okay, I have to go back and write that because I didn't even put that in. She's like, excuse me, you skipped over that part. So I actually had to go in and write a little bit more about that. I had to put a line in there. Yeah, I actually had my first drafts had a lot more about the relationships and my developmental editor said that has to go into a different book. You can write a whole book about Cy and Abby. You can write a whole book about that, but that's a whole other book. You know?
Yeah, that would be fun.
I think like with Yasmina and Bijan, I think they ran into trouble a little bit later, you know, where he was a little snobby. You know, about his background. I have a friend from Iran and she said, absolutely not. There's no way these two are going to get together at all unless she's very beautiful and there's going to be some snob, you know, there's going to be some issues because you know, he's coming from this very high class family in Iran and she's coming from the mountains of Morocco. There's no way. So I made him a little bit snobby and I gave him some problems that they had to overcome.
Yeah.
But no, not until decades later.
Yeah. I love that. And then Cy and Abby, I liked how, like, because Abby's the main character and they definitely, like, I think they all stayed true to who they were. With Cy and Abby, like, she went through a lot of tough things.
Yeah.
falling in love with a great, wonderful, kind person. Having to protect herself and her son when he kind of became an unsafe person for them.
Yeah.
And I thought that was heartbreaking.
That would be really heartbreaking to have happen and experience.
Yeah, that was extremely heartbreaking.
So one thing that I wanted to ask you, just because we were talking a little bit about the Moroccan time period, was Your mother's biological mother kind of almost feels like in the story that Nanette kind of takes the grandmother role more so than her. And I just was curious to know, how did all of that work out? Like with your mother's mother, whatever happened to that relationship?
Yeah, because I didn't put that in the book, did I? What happened later on?
No, and it made sense not to, because it was obviously, you know, Nanette was the mother figure, you know, and you could tell that she raised them. She was the one who he wasn't going to eat unless she was, you know, unless she came back. So it made so much sense. I mean, and it would have clouded it up. It would have clouded the mucked up the waters. And because if you're talking, I was just curious.
Part of that was that in my mom's family, they had to be self-centered. They had to be narcissistic in order to survive. There was a lot of poverty. There was a lot of, it was a lot of disease. Just, you had to be that way.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you weren't going to make it. Like the opposite of demonic kid. You could not have animals landing on you. You had to be really, really self-centered and narcissistic. And if I didn't have a character like Yasmina, the Nanette character would have completely alone. She just would have had seven brothers and a mom who didn't pay attention. And who would have narrated, right? Who would have been there? So I gave the mom character a helper. It's a trope. I mean, she did exist. I remember meeting the maid, but it was kind of like I didn't want the mom character to be going through. It's a love story too. I didn't want her to be going through life alone. And Jillian, it would have been honestly a trauma dump. The whole book would have been a trauma dump, and I didn't want that. I did not want a memoir that was like a trauma memoir. I wanted a piece of fiction that told an emotional truth.
Yeah. Was it common to have 8 children at that time in Morocco? Or was that because of the Jewish heritage? I wasn't sure on that.
Yeah, it was not as much. My editor said, take this out of the book. It was very common for women to have abortion. Abortion was a method of birth control. And my grandmother did not. So she was she was actually tormented a little bit. Like, why aren't you having an abortion? Why are you having 8 children? People usually kept it to a lot fewer, but that was honestly in real life. That was why Nanette had the eating disorder. Her mother was considering an abortion for like the last child, and my mother just could not handle it. And so she went on a hunger strike. Uh-huh. So
she did a lot of hunger.
Yeah. Anorexia.
Yeah. She definitely had some serious anorexia going on.
Yeah.
Then I can't control my life, so I'll control my body.
Which is interesting. I was like, wow, this family, I obviously have 8 children. They needed some help. Because, I mean, my mom was one of 9. And so she was the built-in help. Like, she helped raise the 2 older brothers and the 3 younger brothers directly around her. Like, I kind of picture my mom like Nanette. And so what a gift it would have been to have a Yasmina in her life, in my mom's life.
That's life-changing
for her, I think. But I also viewed them as like, if they can have a servant, so to speak, they must be somewhat well-to-do. Or was it just based purely out of necessity?
It's honestly, it's a little bit like South Africa. You can get a maid for like a penny. I mean, like a penny an hour. I mean, it's almost like slavery over there. Yeah. So they were not well-to-do. They were honestly more like lower middle class. You could be a baker. I mean, no wonder they wanted independence, honestly, from France. You could be a baker and have 2 maids, you know, and these poor women from, you know, the country were treated terribly. I heard it's very similar to South Africa and some parts of South America where you could just, if we went down there, we'd have a maid or 2.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. No, I've heard that for sure. And it like that made me like just love Yasmina that much more because like she was just like brushed off like, oh, you can't have children. So you're of no use. You might as well take care of these other people and go be a servant. And her family didn't even question it. They didn't stop it. They were like, OK, you know, and that broke my heart that happens.
Yeah. You know, I was in Morocco and I was talking to, I don't know, a driver. And he said that if you're a woman and something happens, you become a prostitute. Even now. And I'm like, oh my God.
No, that's absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys have ever read Half the Sky. I couldn't even get through the introduction without like falling apart. I think that's a book that anyone should read, but it does talk about like what is going on with women in the world and how they can so easily be discarded. It's heartbreaking. And I thought you brought that to life really well.
Yeah,
because we forget.
Well, that's why in the end, she gets a good.
I know.
I love that, too. I was like, if anybody deserved a happily ever after, it was her.
Yeah. And I did. I loved that aspect because you have her who like, she could have turned out so differently. But then you had Nanette who, like, she had a little bit more opportunity, and yet she, because she had to be self-protective and look out for herself only, like, she and her husband decided to become, you know, drug
lords. Self-indulgent, yeah.
And kind of discard their children and, like, basically make their children fend for themselves.
Yeah, and that's a multi-generational. That was my grandmother, too. Yeah. My uncles, when you talk to my uncles, well, there's only two left alive out of all of them. But when you talk to them, they say, oh, yeah, it was kind of like Lord of the Flies. We had to fend for ourselves. And I wonder how many generations back that went, where people just were like mothers ill-equipped, focused on themselves, couldn't raise their children. So that's kind of what talk that was about. And you can see how my sister came to be.
Yeah. Yes. You talk about how Nanette, too, even just couldn't parent. She just, you know, having her first child was very difficult, and she didn't know how to care for a child.
Yeah.
It just didn't come naturally, it seems.
No,
She needed Yespina.
Yeah, kind of threatened by the attention the child got. You know, when you're 18 years old, some people can be a mom at 18 and nail it. I mean, some people are just naturally good moms. You know, it doesn't matter. They could be 12. And then some people need to be a little bit older and more mature before they become a mom.
And there's some people who, go on, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think the mom character, she got better when she got older. You know, she started to see some things. But when you're 18 and you don't have much emotional regulation and you're in a different country and you're self-centered, it's hard, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and it seems like so much value was put on being beautiful as a woman, or being, you know, elegant as a dancer. You know, how are you portrayed by the men? My professor is still interested in me and I need to go and, you know, still be alluring to him. And just how that dynamic was, to the point where it's like, okay, if you're going off with your professor for the evening, why are you talking to your, you know, middle school child about this? And but it was just like, oh no, that's my value. My value is that I am desirable. He wants me. I have value there. And I just was like, that's such a sad thing to model.
Yeah, it was as being important. Really well.
And so, yeah, how that had to impact you growing up. I mean, just like, it makes so much sense.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I apologize.
Oh, no,
it impacted all of us growing up. And it continues. I'm not going to go into detail, but I have two nieces who are influencers, and they have their YouTube channels and their Instagram. And it just continues. It's like, if it doesn't stop, it's like you get your value with, you know, what you look like. And that's awesome. I mean, it's great to look wonderful. Hey, I want to look nice too. But when that's all your value, it almost is like, in a way, you can see how women are extremely vulnerable to being trafficked when they're that way, because that's their whole value.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this is
and
what
also
I'm
they're used
for.
To getting validation that way. So if that's the fastest way to get validation down that menu of you have value, you're worthwhile, is through sexuality. I mean, it's the using sexuality is like the cheat code to easy of instant validation, if you want it to be. Mm-hmm. And it's a trap. And I just have to commend you so much on genuinely being fair to everybody in your story. Like everybody, I think it was a real love story, in that it takes true love to actually look at people and acknowledge them and see them for themselves, and not make them Hitler, not make them this, but just truly see them. And I really feel like you saw everyone.
Yeah, which character was the hardest for you to write?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question.
The character that was the hardest was Abby. Mm-hmm. And it was in the middle when Abby, I had to dirty her up a little bit. And it was really, really hard to have her slip, you know, and it was really difficult.
She always took the moral high ground, I feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she was moral high ground all the way through. Right? And then somewhere in the story, I had to have this redemption arc. I wanted a redemption arc for her. I couldn't have her too perfect.
Yeah.
She was poly perfect. So I had to do something. And I think I do wonder about like people when they're up against it, you know, because it's really, really easy to take the moral high ground when you have money, when you have privilege, when everything's gone your way. But mm-hmm. right now, when 40% of people can't afford a car repair bill right now without taking out a credit card loan, there's more and more people getting to be desperate, like they're up against it. And so,
I
do believe in moral relativity sometimes, you know, and it's like, she had to do what she had to do, you know? And right. I mean, she wasn't completely broke. You know, she wanted to keep her son and Bree, but, you know, she had to do something. And so that was hard to write, very hard to write.
Did you also, with that arc, I liked how the son was kind of her catalyst for pulling it back in when he called her out. And I think that that showed a lot of generational healing, because you have these parents who've been ignoring their children essentially for so many years. And I thought that it really showed a ton of healing having the son be the person who said, "Mom, you're making a mistake."
Yeah, he is the one that broke the family.
Yeah, he's the one that
He
triggered it because, you know, everyone, just the way that they were living, showed that mistakes were happening. But it shows a mother's love of her child. And like that actually broke kind of this cycle, because when she saw that, oh my gosh, I'm having a moment where I'm kind of doing something similar, I love that it was her seeing her child, which I don't think happened in this story up until that point. Like, she saw her child and was like, okay, I will address this, and I will acknowledge the feedback you're giving me and make change. And I thought that was so beautiful.
Yeah, I just, you know, that's the thing. Of course, that did not happen in real life. I did not, you know, get in trouble with the Board of Behavior Science. But but people said it was very believable.
It was believable. We were actually going to tiptoe around that.
That was made up. I had to take some poetic license there, artistic license.
Yeah, but I loved that.
Yeah, and I really thought it was so, on so many levels, it was satisfying because you embedded so much into that. And I love that we are getting this interview with you, so we're finding out how you developed that. And that was so perfect because it made so much sense. It's like you said, that redemption cycle in that character helped us see the healing more.
Yeah. And was there, I mean, as far as scenes go, was this one of the harder scenes to write, or which was what part?
Yeah, that
of
was a really
was
tough one, especially. So when my son read it, the first few times I wrote it, I had to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, because this was really hard not to get like really snarky with all the other characters. It was really tough. My son read it. He's like, "Mom, you make me sound crazy." So I had to go back and rewrite it. And he's like, "You make me sound like I'm nuts." Like, and I'm like, because you know, I'm really thinking for my son, because I only have one boy. And I'm like, okay. So I went back and I had to have it where he was desperate too. And he didn't know what to do. And so then it read a lot better. But I do feel like I have a son who's taught me a lot, because he has the kind of personality that he doesn't take any. Am I allowed to swear on this a little bit?
Absolutely.
Okay, he doesn't take any shit. Okay. He's been that way since he was born. Right. If my parents had had him as a kid, one of them would have died. Okay. Because he just does. I always say that. And so I've always had to listen to him, because he's very logical, you know? So he'll just, like, if you do something wrong, you're going to know it. You're going to know you did something wrong. You know, those kind of people.
I love.
So I have a choice. Either I listen to him or there's going to be World War III. And he's usually right.
Your family's tenacity, you probably were. He's like, you know what? No, because you know what? I've seen, I understand. If we don't address this, it's just going to hit the fan.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that part.
You know, it says on the back cover, some families leave you money, others leave you scars. Mm-hmm. Where did that kind of come from as far as the book's concerned?
Well, okay. So, you know, because I'm older, a lot of my friends, their parents leave them $1 million, a house, blah, blah, blah. I had to bury both of my parents, just put it that way. So it's kind of a joke. Yeah. It's kind of a jokey thing.
Yeah.
And honestly, I wouldn't have it any other way because I've learned so much in this life, you know, from having the parents that I had. In terms of, like, when you say that I was able to write about these people with authenticity and understanding, I think that's really what I've learned. And on the job, oh my gosh, it's helped me so much. Like when a family comes in, you know, because I work in the schools, I'm going to be retiring in June. But when a family comes in, just to have, it's one thing to have empathy. It's another thing to really understand their lived experience. And I think that that's really helped me in life. I'm not saying I'm perfect because sometimes I can get really annoyed. But it's really helped a lot. See the world.
And where do you see that? I was going to ask you how that quote relates to Yasmina, Nanette, and Abby.
How does it? I don't know. I can't. That's a good question. What do you think?
Well, I think for Yasmina, if I were going to answer it,
yeah.
And you can just say, no, that's not what I was going for. But like with Yasmina, some people leave you, your family, like her family left her nothing and they discarded her.
Yeah.
And you would have thought she'd be very scarred from that.
Yeah.
But she was always so generous and kind and loving. Yeah. So I would say that she wasn't scarred by her family. I think she became more generous and loving than anyone else in the book. And so I loved that part about her. For Nanette, I would say she had to fend for herself too. Like she wasn't really given a lot by her family either. And it really deeply scarred her and it made her very selfish. And she wasn't not nurturing.
Yeah.
And I think that she then projected that forward onto Nikki, you know?
Yeah.
And then Abby, she would have been the third person.
Abby had the same experience as Nikki for the most part, but it's just, it's a difference of personality.
I think when you look at scars, though, like,
I loved
this, like, in high school, they had us write up a scar chart of our body and tell the stories about our scars. And I think for some people, like they can look at a scar and just have this terrible experience and say how awful it made their life. And others can be like, I really got strong from that and I learned a lot.
Yeah.
And I think the way that we react, how we come out of things, if we can look at the silver lining, which is what I think Abby did.
Yeah. And I think also maybe Abby had more support as far as Yasmina being there than Nikki did. Nikki had no parental support.
That's right.
At all.
Yeah.
That's right.
And so her might have been
a little deeper.
Yeah. And Abby had insight. No, Abby had the insight to go, I don't know that I really need to work super hard to appease these parents, because I don't know that these are the people whose approval I really want in life. You know, I'd rather find approval from, you know, the cheerleading squad or these other places that are more positive. Like, I don't want to go down this pathway. And she had that insight. But also, I don't think that they were getting her stoned when she was four either.
Yeah, exactly. So, birth order makes a big difference.
Who knows what else?
Yeah, birth order.
So she had a little bit of a free time because the parents hadn't broken quite so much.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Yeah, I think the birth order was a big deal. Like if I had been born in 1968 instead of 1960, because, you know, untreated mental illness always gets worse. And so my parents, you know, kind of progressively got worse. And so, or the parents in the story. And so being born when, you know, the sister Nikki was born, that was a big disadvantage. She didn't get the attention.
Oh.
And then also the genetics part. It's like, you know, I mean, talk about a bad roll of the dice. You know, she got the worst kind of genetics from each parent, you know. That's hard.
And then she was also nurtured that way.
Yeah.
By like severe neglect. She was nurtured to really struggle and have to look out for herself.
And
in real life,
it broke my heart.
In real life, the middle sister took on the role of parent. The middle sister in real life was like a parent figure, but the middle sister was only a couple of years older. So it was kind of like, you know, middle sister trying to raise her. So yeah, that was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Thank you, man.
That is.
You did such a good job of how you wrote it. Like when you just had Nikki at 4 years old, because she knew that mom loved to dance and she was in the dance things. And when you had her at that celebration, just dancing her butt off at 4 years old, not for herself, not because she just wanted to go and dance, but because she wanted her mom to see that she was good at it and that she really wanted her mom's approval and attention like all the other little babies and all the other kids were getting. She wanted that from her mom and she was working so hard for it and she never got it. And yeah. It just like that just that moment created just so much empathy for her. Yeah. Like it was just like, wow, you know, to be because you can tell that she had intelligence, that she had awareness.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, to be that smart at that young of an age, she was so savvy. And to want nothing more than just to have your mom glance at you while you're dancing and to try to earn it and then to not get it and to be aware that you didn't get it at such a young age.
So to jump off of that, I just want to know, in the context of your story, how do you define love and what does love mean to you?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Fast. Okay, so that was a good question. Love is like, okay, so the Abby and Cy character, they still love each other, right? I mean, they're not together. They still love each other. It doesn't have to look like a happy ever after. You know, I was a big romance reader, still read romances, but it's not like, it's not like Cinderella where everything ends up perfect. And I think you can still have people love each other and care for each other and not be in love with each other.
Yep.
And so I think that that's the message. And then I also a big love for a mother and their child, you know, kind of like the, my son just had a baby on Thanksgiving Day. His wife just had a baby.
Oh, congratulations.
My daughter-in-law, a little girl, and my daughter-in-law sent me pictures. She sent me a video and I could see she's like talking to the baby and the baby's cooing back. And my heart, I was like, oh my gosh, this baby is getting what she needs. She's got this whole family to support her. And, you know, my daughter-in-law is singing to her. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that is love. That is such, mother and child love just gets to me. Yes. I mean, all kinds of love. But because when you love a child like that, you equip them to be able to love a partner, you know?
Yeah, you do.
I feel like maybe my generation didn't get it right. Like, I didn't get the happily ever after, but my son, I'm really confident that he's going to get the happy ever after because he can attach to other people. He's got the attachment. He's able to do that. Able to find a healthy partner. And so I feel like the curse has been broken. So I hope I'm defining love.
Well, I think that's the best.
Absolute
unconditional love that only a mother can give.
Yes.
Well, maybe I shouldn't say that, but I mean, I always tell my kids there's nothing you could ever do that would make me not love you.
It's
not in me.
It's kind of like if my son went to prison, I'd bake a cake with a file in it, just put it that way.
Right? And we won't do anything.
Yes, that's what we do for our children.
I love it.
I think you're absolutely right. The love, you know, a mother has for her children is huge.
Yeah. So I loved that. What do you hope that readers take home? Take away from this book?
Well, you know, so far, everybody's taken something different.
Yeah. Well, that's a great book.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, I hope I took people on a journey and I hope that they had moments of like, aha, oh my God, you know, I can relate to this or this has changed my life. That was kind of my goal. Now, come on, that's a big goal. So I know I'm not going to do that for everybody, but I love that when I read a book and it's like, I'm still thinking about it a couple days later, where sometimes I'll read a book and it's great all the way through. And then like, it's like watching a movie, like you forget about it the next day. And I'm just hoping I wrote a book that stays with people.
Yeah, no, this one stuck.
This one will
stick.
And I want to say just interviewing with you, I want to say thank you. I'm going to cry. It's like, this really helped tie some things up in my life. Like with my mom.
Thank you.
It's a lot of relatable things. So
there are actually.
I appreciate that. And that's kind of what my goal originally was for me, because, you know, writers write the first draft for themselves. But once I was done with that, I really wanted to see if I could write something that other people, especially women, I think it's mostly a woman's book, could relate to and maybe can help them in their own lives.
Yeah. For sure. No, you definitely have I've had a few aha moments here. Just listening to your story and just having you talk a little bit more about each of these characters, I'm like, oh, this makes sense.
Thank you.
Helps me understand my own family a little bit better.
Yeah, definitely. It was a very honest book with a lot of beautiful, genuine themes. And I think anybody who reads this book can find a gem in it.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I appreciate it because I got scammed. Okay. So one thing about coming from a family of scammers, sometimes you're easily scammed because you do want to always believe people. So mm-hmm. I have to watch out. I always have to run this by somebody else. I'm not going to make any decisions anymore. So I got scammed by a book marketer and then I confronted them. And 6 hours later, I had my first review on Amazon and it was a rating. It was horrible. It's my first review. It was terrible. Read it. If people buy it and read it, just leave a review. That would be great.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to.
For a publishing journey, any ups and downs with that?
Yeah, so I guess it's a story of overconfidence because I knew I had a really good book. So I thought, oh my God, for sure, some agent is going to want to snap this up, blah, blah, blah. Well, it doesn't work that way because I think I was really, honestly, should have done a little more research about my letter, my query letter, and maybe my first chapter. So I thought a little bit I can do this myself. That's kind of very short version. And of course, had some scams. Still, every day I have a scammer trying to contact me about telling me what a fantastic book I am and how they can help me be a bestseller and everything. And so it's kind of been crazy. It's honestly, being a book, marketing your own book, it's way different from writing. Writing is an art mm-hmm. and marketing is marketing.
Right.
And yeah. I don't really like it that much. I like talking to people.
Oh my goodness. Well, this has been phenomenal.
Yeah. And your book is phenomenal. You really wrote a great book.
Yeah.
Yeah, we really liked it.
I think that people will get a lot from it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So
thank you.
I'd want to promote the hell out of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I actually decided since I'm retiring in June.
Congrats.
I'm going on the road. I signed up with the Jewish Book Council, mm-hmm. which is what they do is they actually pay for you to travel all these different places to do presentations. So
that's awesome.
Here I am. I've been shy all my life and here I'm going to be hitting the road.
Oh, you're going to do a great job.
Yes. And please, if you come up into this area, we would love to see you.
Oh, yeah. I would love to meet you.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Okay, yeah. So are you in Coeur d'Alene?
Yeah.
Coeur d'Alene, Spokane.
And Dover, yes.
Sandpoint. Sandpoint. Yeah. But,
okay.
But if you have a traveling list agenda, let me know. I would post that that, anybody that's listening and if they're in the area that you're going to be. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. This is my favorite part.
Oh,
thank you.
Well, we really appreciate you and today. Thank you for writing your book. We really, really enjoyed it.
And then I'm just going to say to our listeners out there, check out our website. We will have everything posted about her book and about Debbie on there. Then how you can get a hold of us too.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, Debbie, what platforms, when people want to buy your book, how can they buy it? Where can they find it? Where can they get more information? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so of course, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I actually am in a couple libraries, but not that many. So I don't think you can get it at the library at this point. The audiobook just came out. Mm-hmm. And again, like I said, Lorianne is narrating it, so she did a great job.
That's amazing.
Anybody just wants to go to my website and listen to chapter one, they can.
Oh, that's a great. So and tell us your website again. I know we'll put it
on our website, but just in case people don't make it around to going to our website and they want to.
Yeah, do you want to say your website right now?
Yeah, it's debbyshow.com, debbyshow.com.
Perfect.
And I'm having it revamped. So it's going to be pretty right now.
I love it. And if you want to go to our website, it's www.myperfectromance.com. Debbie.com.
Yep. And then you'll see a link in the interviews to all of Debbie's info.
Socials and her website and all that good stuff and stuff about her book. So congrats on publishing.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you. Take care. Nice to meet you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
XOXO.
XOXO.